372. The LDS Church's policy changes on LGBT parents and their children. There's a book here I'm supposed to read to you, All the Things You're Supposed to Do to Behave. I assume you've heard them enough today. So as when I was in the bishopric, the bishop went away, and I just stood up and said to everybody, behave yourself for a week while the bishop's gone. So I say that again here. Just behave yourself for the next hour and a half. We won't have any untold problems or issues. Very happy to welcome you here, and some of you are probably exhausted from all of the sunstoning. But I'm pleased to be on a panel with three distinguished people and dear friends of mine who have collectively been involved in issues relating to LGBT and the Mormon community for probably collectively 100 years, probably more than that. Carolyn, you have 90 years almost by yourself. Oh, excuse me, dear, I didn't mean that. This is a repeat of a panel we did at the Berkeley Symposium in January, so we should be extremely well prepared for it. And I just want to pay homage to these people who have, with courage and great faith and especially great love, have been involved in what I think is the core of the gospel of Christ, to be kind and considerate and helpful and nurturing to people in our community who are in great need of those Christian virtues. So I'm going to say a few words at the beginning, and then we'll listen to Carolyn, and then Mitch, and then Caitlin, and then I will say some words at the end, and I hope we have room for questions and answers. I've asked each of them to take 15 minutes, and I will be a taskmaster, pulling on sleeves and other pieces of clothing. Okay, now you tell me after I gave my talk. Okay. Lean in, is that the word? Lean in. Okay, how's that? Something dramatic has happened within the Mormon community since November, when the church announced a change in policy relating to same-sex married gays and lesbians and their children. A policy so seemingly at odds with past practices and gospel principles as to be shocking to many. This change has led to what I characterize in a response to the policy as a disturbance in the field. As I wrote, although this term has specific meaning both within physics and psychotherapy, I'm using it here to describe a significant disruption in the social and emotional fabric of the LDS Church, a disturbance of the normal, healthy functioning of the organization. While such disturbances are predictable, they are nonetheless challenging and can be wrenching both to the organization or system and to its constituents' parts, individual members, as is clearly the case with regard to LGBT members and their families and friends affected by the church's new policy change. Since the initial announcement, two additional events have increased the level of disturbance over this issue. Elder Russell Nelson's address to a worldwide devotional of young adults in January, and the report in January of a number of suicides, 32 by that count, of young LGBT Mormons directly related to the change. In regard to the first, Elder Nelson stated something that had not even been part of the announcements or explanations to that point. That is, that the change in policy had been revealed to President Thomas S. Monson and confirmed by certain spiritual witness to other members of the First Presidency in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, thus ensuring the indelible imprimatur of prophetic and apostolic authority, and establishing a clear and certain demarcation between those who accept his statement as factual and those who have reason to question it. The implication seems as clear as the words of the hymn we sing, "Who's on the Lord's side? Who?" The implication of which, if you aren't on the side of the institutional church or church authorities, you can't be on the Lord's side. But some Latter-day Saints feel they are on the Lord's side, but not on the church's side on this issue. This is one of the reasons why some Latter-day Saints are experiencing a disturbance in their spiritual field, unlike any they have experienced before. That is, on so many issues, race, polygamy, the historicity of the Book of Mormon, feminism, the providence of the Book of Abraham, and women's ordination, there's always been, or at least seemed to be, some space for difference, for discussion, and for even dissent. Since Elder Nelson's address, however, there seems to be no such space on the matter of same-sex intimacy and marriage. Causing perhaps an even greater disturbance in the field of faith was the reported 32 suicides of young LGBT Mormons tied directly to the policy change. However reliable the data on suicides is, the fact that remains that many deaths constitutes a tragedy of gigantic proportions that cannot be covered up, brushed aside, or silenced by a few platitudes. I came into Utah early this week and someone told me that there had been even more suicides from of young people, 10 to 16, and as I was lamenting this, someone said, well, one of the explanations is the altitude and the inversion here, and I can't rule out any possibility, but experience teaches me that it's obviously much more complicated than that. However reliable the data on suicides is, the fact remains that many deaths constitutes a tragedy of gigantic proportions that cannot be covered up, brushed aside, or silenced by a few platitudes. Can anyone imagine the response if that many Latter-day Saints had died of a virus or been victims of a mass shooting? How does one get her heart and mind around such a statistic and the colossal pain and heartache it represents? How does one make sense of something that seems to defy sense? The panelists today will try to help sort this out. First, we'll hear from Carolyn Pearson, who will be followed by Mitch Main, who will in turn be followed by Caitlin Ryan. Before turning over to the session over to questions and answers, I will try to have a few concluding remarks and hopefully leave abundant time for discussion. Carolyn.
Is this sound system even acceptable?
Yes.
Is it okay? I am here just to give a few personal observations. I'm not a scholar like all the other people here. I'm not even a wannabe scholar. I'm just a wannabe so-called scholar. But I am a human being who has had a lot of experience on this, and I'm going to take just a few short minutes to offer some of my thoughts on what's been going on here. Of course, everybody in this room likely is saddened by the subject that we're talking about. Directly after the announcement or the leaking of the new policies, I got up to bear my testimony in sacrament meeting the very next time that it was available, and I don't do it regularly, and I never say all the regular things, but I got up and I said, I just wanted to bear my testimony to a very, very specific thing, and that very, very specific thing is the gospel of Jesus Christ. I said, when I was a young girl, I was given a Bible. My sister since reminds me that at the death of our mother, when I was 15 and she was 13, we were each given a Bible. It's a white Bible that's just totally falling apart. But the first thing I noticed about it was that some of the words were printed in red. And I soon learned that it was what's called a red letter Bible, meaning that those letters that were printed in red are, as far as can be determined, the words that Jesus himself actually said. And so obviously those were going to be the really, really important words. And so I've tried to keep my focus on those words as the gospel of Jesus Christ, that is supposed to be the good news, that is supposed to lead us in the best direction possible. And then I said, after Christ, everybody who claimed to be a follower of his, from whatever religion claimed to take his name, developed doctrines. And sometimes if those doctrines turned out to feel godly and good, they often held. And all of the organizations who took Jesus' name created policies. And if those policies turned out to be good, they were held. And if they were not good, they did not hold. And that's all I really said about the policies. But I thanked the brothers and sisters in my ward for walking with me and for being among those who clearly try to follow the red letter words of Christ. We've seen over the last number of months so much extraordinary distress that has come from that. So many family members have said to me, you know, that was the last straw. My kids now, all four of them are out of the church. Just the day before I came here, got an email from a woman back east said, I finally left my church after November. She was a convert, so thrilled to have found this church. We've lost her. We've lost too many. We're in a very, very, very strange place. One of the things that I sent out on my Facebook was this interesting, sad little rewrite that a man had done of, there's a grief that can't be spoken. There's a pain goes on and on. Empty chairs at empty tables. Now my friends are dead and gone. That from Les Mis. But his meaning was very, very clear, and he made it even more clear by the end. Oh, my friends, forgive me that I stay while you are gone. And this grief that can't be spoken just goes on and on and on. It does. And a few of the things that are very puzzling to me as I try to figure out how it is that our otherwise, in so many ways, wonderful organization has come to be comfortable with something that, to my mind, should make us all quite uncomfortable. I think about Doctrine and Covenants 121, and I say, why is it not being followed in this measure? You know, that place that says, if you feel to reprimand somebody, that give quickly an outpouring of love, lest that person esteem you to be his enemy. Why has that not happened? It may have happened way down here at the bottom in the church with a small c. I've been watching, and I haven't seen it happen anywhere at the top, an increase of love for those that have been so severely reprimanded. Just the reprimand, followed by silence. And I think, too, of a song that all of us have sung. I learned every verse of it when I was younger and practicing the guitar. The poor wayfaring man of grief, who could fit that description better than our dear LGBT brothers and sisters? And if you'll remember with me just for a moment those verses and see if these don't qualify as a description of those many young suicides that have been spoken of. the families who are in great distress. First, we saw him hungry. Our young people are so hungry to be accepted, so hungry for some connection to a spiritual home, thirsty. Our young LGBT people are so thirsty for the word of God that tells them that they are loved. Homeless? We have so many that are homeless. Beaten? Too many of our LGBT brothers and sisters have been beaten, viciously abused. In prison? Perhaps, but at least in a prison within themselves, for which some of them find no escape but to take their lives or to wither into tremendous distress. And so it is my hope that before long, all of us down here at the bottom and in the small C, and way up at the top with the church of the large C and the corporation of the large C, might be able to remember, as we sing this final verse, those among us who are indeed the most representative of what's being talked about, realizing then in a moment to my view the stranger started from disguise. The tokens in his hands, I knew the Savior stood before my eyes. He spake, and my poor name he spoke. Of me thou hast not been ashamed. These deeds shall thy memorial be. Fear not, thou didst them unto me. May the day come soon that we can all of us sing that song and know that we have recognized in those who are most needy of our attention, most needy of our love, and who, to the surprise of many, are going to turn out to be the Lord himself. May that day come soon.
So as I prepared my remarks for today, I think a lot of us have felt over the past several months this deep, just darkness. Can you speak? Can you?
Pick it up.
All right.
Just hold it.
I won't hold it. All right. The irony, of course, is I can usually do this without a microphone in a room this big, but this, for some reason, I feel quiet. So when I started writing my remarks about this particular subject, I recognized that all of us are in such a very, very dark place right now. And a core component of who I am and how I have managed to navigate my path inside Mormonism as a gay man is optimism. And yes, I am an optimist. I think you kind of have to be a gay Mormon. And I wrote my remarks with that particular idea in mind. Back in 2011, when I first got the calling to serve with Bishop Fletcher in San Francisco, I had a lot of people enter my life in a very short period of time. Some of these people were really happy and enthusiastic to see this out gay man accepting a calling like this, and other people, you know, they weren't so happy about things, and they weren't shy about letting me know that. But either way, my life was full of new faces and new people. One of them included this Mormon woman who assumed kind of like a motherly role to me. She had had a gay son. She had a gay son, and she was very kind and supportive to me, and we kept in contact over the period of the first couple of months of my calling. I finally had an occasion to meet her in person, and it was a really nice meeting, but she did something to me that was pretty startling. She pulled me aside and she grabbed me by the hand and she said, "Mitch, you need to know something. You are going to be seriously tested right now." And I was kind of taken aback because that's not the sort of thing that we really like to hear inside Mormonism. And then she continued in this very grave and sincere Mormon fashion, "Men are going to throw themselves at your feet now." Outwardly, I retained my calm demeanor, but secretly inside, I was thinking, yes. Well, alas, that prophecy never came to pass. There was no brigade of firemen at my front door, and my dance card looks pretty much like it did before I took the calling in the first place. But she was right about one thing, that woman. The test did come. It didn't come in the way that she said it would, but it did arrive, and for me, it arrived in the form of anger. I will admit that prior to November, I had some really frustrating situations that I encountered, but nothing really hooked me into my anger for an extended length of time. I'm kind of lucky in that I entered this calling with a really deep and diverse spiritual practice, a core component of which is the ability to unhook me from my anger in a very, very quick time frame. The reason for that is because when I am in my anger, I am disconnected from my Savior, I am off my spiritual center, and truth be told, I am really of no use to anyone, myself included. But there's another reason for me, and it's a purely selfish reason. Because when I feel like I have allowed someone or something to make me angry for an extended period of time, I have allowed that thing to control me and to control my peace of mind, and that power belongs rightly and exclusively to me and to my Savior. November's policy brought with it a new test and a new level of anger for me. I view the policy as essentially foreclosing the futures of our LGBT Mormon youth. It gives us, as gay Mormons, this really, really awful Sophie's choice. On the one hand, we can buy into this notion that we are afflicted and suffering and sick with same-sex attraction and choose to live a solitary life, half-life really, of being alone for this existence. Or on the other, if we're lucky enough to fall in love and marry and have a family of our own, we risk being cast off from the church. And for a believing Mormon, that means from our families for eternity. That is a really difficult decision to place on the shoulders of the most capable LGBT individual. That is a cruel decision to thrust upon the shoulders of our LGBT Mormon youth who are already, in many instances, on shaky ground because of the way they have been taught to view themselves inside our faith. The clarification issued by Elder Nelson, for me personally, made things a little worse. Not only was there the contention that this was revelation from God, but there was also the notion, a very creative description, if you will, of how the policy came to be. For most of us, we have realized and heard that the policy came to be in a very different fashion, which runs very counter to Elder Nelson's claim. And what that difference, what the difference in those encounters did for me was it put out something that I had held, a little flame of hope that I had held for a long, long time. And that was this notion that my leaders were good men who wanted to do the right thing, but were just misguided and misled on this topic. Hearing Elder Nelson give a dishonest account of that policy and the subsequent silence of the remaining 12 squashed and extinguished that last flame of hope for me. Yet, I still remain optimistic. Optimism for me is the antidote, or one of the antidotes to anger. And I think, as I look for the silver lining here, it's actually pretty clear. Mormons are waking up about how the church policy affects our LGBT youth and are starting to understand that maybe we have held the wrong position on LGBT people for a very, very long time. Here are some of the things that I am optimistic about. Number one, When the policy was first announced, my email box flooded from Mormons across the country. These were people that previously had not written to me or had not spoken to me, and traditionally had not even supported marriage equality, but now we're thinking about things pretty dramatically differently. I think just like Proposition 8 did, this policy is going to do more to foster LGBT inclusiveness and allyship within the Mormon religion than any grassroots education effort that we could mobilize. I want to read you the quote from one woman that came in during that time. Quote, "I am a lifelong Mormon. I have been a firm opponent of LGBT marriage. But this, especially with the exclusion of children, is too much for me to bear. This has caused me to examine everything that I thought I knew. And you know what? I think I'm a lot more progressive than I ever thought I was." The second thing that we have to be optimistic about is our mama dragons. I will applaud for that one too. When this group began in 2013, it was eight women, eight moms of LGBT Mormon youth, and I think I knew every single one of them personally. Today, there's almost 1,000 Mama Dragons across the country. And that actually does deserve applause. Well, some of these women are brand spanking new to this, and I just met one in the hallway a little while ago. They don't really know the language quite yet, and they're a little clumsy and a little shy about this. These women are a resource for good and for power that we have never had access to before. Number three, local LGBT outreach that is happening across the country. So across the country since the November policy, there has been a wellspring of LGBT firesides driven by members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm going to pick on one called All Arizona that's been around for a little while to start with because it's one of my favorites and it's one of the biggest. All Arizona, for those of you who don't know about it, was started by Bryce and Sarah Cook about 5 years ago, I think, as an occasional meeting they had in their living room. In this 5 years, it has grown to over 500 people and is now hosted in the homes of families around the Phoenix area. In fact, there's a little side joke we tell ourselves in the Mormon LGBT community and refer to the Phoenix area as Gay Zion because it has so many of these amazing, wonderful, and supporting families. In my own area, in the San Francisco area, we've had for about a year monthly firesides that feature LGBT topics. These were started by a bishop, a seated bishop, and his wife. And originally, the stake leadership was kind of lukewarm about them. They allowed them to happen, but they weren't particularly supportive. But once the November policy was stated, that same stake presidency came to the bishop who started these firesides and declared himself all in when it came to LGBT outreach. That attitude and those firesides are being replicated around the country, including as far away as Virginia. In our own area, in San Francisco proper, we missed a few beats when Bishop Fletcher left and moved to Kansas. But I'm happy to report that starting in September, we will be renewing LGBT firesides in the homes of Mormons in the San Francisco city, starting with yours truly, who gets to be the kickoff speaker for the renewal effort. This list isn't comprehensive, but what I wanted to do here today, this is a very dark and somber topic, but I want us to remember that there is light to be found within this. I don't want to minimize the pain or the loss of our families or our community right now. At the same time, I think our Savior is giving us reasons to be optimistic. I think it's good that we speak about our pain and our lost loved ones. At the same time, there are always concerns about copycat behaviors when we give a good deal of attention given to issues like these. So let's be careful in our comments and gently remind our friends to do the same. Provocative language is still provocative, regardless of which side of the issue we are on. So let's remember that we can advocate in firm ways and not cross the line into abusive rhetoric. And as we share our pain and we share our stories, let's also share resources, like the ones Dr. Ryan will talk about in a moment here. Whenever I talk about the policy, which seems to be the thing everybody wants to talk about lately, I strive diligently to find the optimism. I am a firm believer that life does not present us a problem that does not have a gift in its hands for us. And while it's difficult sometimes to see those gifts, I still have faith that our Savior can take this rocky, ugly stone and carve it into something beautiful. For while these changes may have come as a surprise to many, they didn't come as a surprise to him. He already has a plan to make it right.
Good afternoon. It's so exciting to see this room almost filled and to be here with these wonderful people once again in Utah, where our paths have crossed many times. As most of you know, I'm not a Mormon. I was called. I was actually called to work on health and mental health for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and now transgender people 41 years ago as a much younger social worker and researcher. And I followed that path for a very long time. And in the late 1980s, as I was working in the AIDS epidemic, it brought me to Utah to start teaching about sexual orientation and the later gender identity here. And I've done extensive education since that time. I've worked with LGBT Mormons, their families, religious leaders, as you know, developed LDS-specific research-based family education materials with the help of intrepid leaders like Bob and Mitch and Wendy and Tom Montgomery, and done this material in the context of the lives of families, cultures, and faith communities, not just for Mormons, because our work is evidence-based, it's much broader and it's much larger, and it's across all cultures and communities. But as I began to apply our work to our religious findings, because we studied religious practice and the effect of faith-based rejection and support on LGBT children as part of our work, I was drawn to apply this work with Mormons First, because as you know, the core of our work is families, and the core of Mormon life is families. So since then, with Bob and Bill Bradshaw and others, I've met with many ecclesiastical leaders at many levels to inform and try to move them to understand what our research from the Family Acceptance Project shows, how they can help support families to educate and guide and support their LGBT children without asking them to change their values or doctrine, which I think is a powerful part of our work. As some of you know who know about our work, we've studied and identified in a multiple series of research studies, over 100 specific ways that parents and caregivers respond to their LGBT children. This includes more than 50 rejecting behaviors and 50 accepting behaviors. And then we could show empirically for the first time with research that how parents and caregivers respond to their LGBT children, how they treat them with actions, words, behaviors, subtly and less so, more directly, affects their risk and well-being as a young adult. We found that a lot of those rejecting behaviors, for example, were related to a more than 8 times greater likelihood of suicide. Extraordinary, because most of the families who were engaging those behaviors thought they were helping their children, helping keep them safe, protect them from harm, keep their families together. We also found that these behaviors were related to, rejection was related to an increased risk for substance abuse, depression, a range of suicidal behaviors and self-harm. It affected low self-esteem, sexual risk behaviors, even a young person's ability to have a support system as a young adult. We studied over 50 accepting behaviors, And we found that these behaviors not only protected against suicide, substance abuse, depression, but they boosted a child's overall health. One day I was talking to a mom and she said, well, what's a protective factor? What does that really mean? And I said, well, think of it like a vaccine. Accepting your LGBT child is like inoculating them with love and protecting them against all of those serious health risks and boosting their sense of self-worth. We identified a lot of common rejecting behaviors, and we haven't really published every single thing yet. We still have a lot more studies to come out with. But these are very common in Mormon life, like trying to change your child's sexual orientation or gender identity, denying their LGBT identity, telling the young person that what they're experiencing is just a phase, they'll grow out of it. There's no such thing as a lesbian, gay, or bisexual identity. Actually, what you're feeling is really just a sexual attraction. So it's not real, and you're not real. Preventing a young person from an LGBT youth from having an LGBT friend or participating in an LGBT support group like a gay-straight alliance or learning about who they are, these are rejecting behaviors that we found were related to a 9 times greater likelihood of attempted suicide. And yet think about how common those family reactions are in the lives of families that are really trying to help that child or a bishop who's misinformed and misguided and doesn't really understand what sexual orientation and gender identity really is. These are some of the rejecting behaviors that we've shown are related to serious health risks, including suicide, and that are reinforced in the broader church to the family church. Think about what we heard earlier this afternoon, the term connectedness, connections. That web of connections is really at the heart of Mormon families and Mormon culture. And that is the most important factor that research has shown, including our research from the Family Acceptance Project, in protecting against suicide, connections. So if we think about the impact of this policy, exclusion on the one side, isolation, separation from bonds and ties, and connectedness on the other, we begin to get a sense of what the powerful impact of this policy really means in the day-to-day lives of children and adolescents. We studied more than 50 family accepting behaviors and helped scores of families learn to support their LGBT children, even if they thought, even when they think, that being gay or transgender is wrong. These include behaviors like sitting and talking with your child, even if you're uncomfortable, even if you think this is wrong, to really try to learn and understand from them what this really means. Requiring that other family members respect your child and treat them with respect, just like everyone else in the family. Standing up for them when others mistreat them because of who they are in the family, in the community, in schools, and in congregations. These are ways that we have shown empirically protect against risk and promote well-being. But providing information and guidance in the LDS world is extremely difficult since misinformation about sexual orientation runs so deep and has been embedded across generations. But if I've learned anything from 3 decades of relationships and my missionary work, if you want to call that, with the Mormons, is that family is at the heart of every interaction, and the culture is rooted in connectedness, in how parents nurture and rear their children, how family bonds are continually reinforced through worship, service, recreation, and tradition from this life into the eternities. So thinking about the reinforcement of connection and the loss of connection, we begin to understand the incredibly powerful impact that exclusion and lack of a plan, lack of a future, lack of a sense of being able to be connected to your family would have on children and adolescents. The current church policy makes LGBT children, LGBT people, and the children of lesbian and gay adults a separate class that aren't worthy of spiritual sustenance or religious education for those children. It undermines their spiritual health and their bonds of connectedness. It discourages LDS leaders, family members, and others from supporting LGBT youth, from validating, tolerating, or even allowing parents to support their LGBT children and promote their well-being. It requires, as we know, the children of lesbian and gay parents to disavow their parents in order to be connected with the church. And this undermines all the tenets of strengthening families and supporting family bonds. And it prevents and makes it harder for parents, families, and others to speak out against the mistreatment of LGBT people. And yet protecting their LGBT children through parental advocacy is one of the most important and powerful accepting behaviors in our research. It prevents parents, families, caregivers, others from even understanding mistreatment, since it's really just seen as that's the way things are. And it reinforces the separation and marginalization through daily family and religious practices. It isolates young people from their families and their congregations that are critical sources of connection and support, and reinforces for them into the future that there is no place for them in the church, therefore no place for them in the family, the core unit of emotional, social, and spiritual support for all Mormons and the LGBT community. So what, in essence, is the emotional impact? Deepens feelings of isolation, hopelessness and despair, lack of the future. I think of Jordan Montgomery in our family education film, Families Are Forever, which, by the way, is a best practice. It's the only Mormon best practice for suicide prevention for LGBT young people in the National Best Practices Registry. And Jordan says, "There wasn't any plan for me." Jordan meant that as a gay adolescent in that system, there was no future for him. And imagine what that means. Youth with no options for the future are at significant risk for serious health and mental health problems, including early death from suicide, addiction, violence, and disease. Depression, self-harm, lack of self-worth that increases risk, and suicidal behavior. The children of lesbian and gay parents see their parents, whom they love, as being undermined, marginalized, and devalued. This affects their relationships, connectedness, sense of place, and family cohesion. Every time I've met with, educated, or provided training for LDS religious leaders over the last 8 years, I've talked about the underlying risks for LGBT youth as a result of social stigma. And I've pointed out the dearth of accurate information about sexual orientation and gender identity in children and adolescents among families and religious leaders. The early ages of coming out, we documented on average that lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth self-identified at about age 13, but we found many young people who had a sense of who they were, that they were gay, maybe the language was a little different between ages 7 and 12, and this is increasing because of the social information age in which we live, the availability of talking about this in public settings, in all kinds of places. I also predicted that we would see not only increased vulnerability because of lack of services, guidance, and support for families and extended family members, but we would also see an increase in suicides among Mormon youth, unless the church started to provide accurate information for prevention and support. As Bob well knows, we've given many copies of our LDS family education booklet to religious leaders. Those booklets, some of you, I think, have read them. Actually, they have some of them here. Kurt from Benchmark Books has them. These actually show how rejection and acceptance in the context of Mormon culture increase risk and promote well-being. I encouraged the church to disseminate these materials, and I even volunteered to train the bishop's hotline staff. I'm still waiting to hear back about that. Like Mitch, though, I haven't given up hope. The exclusion policy has ultimately tipped a precarious balance that preexisted, and it's ripped away the semblance of support for LGBT young people who saw for some time in their young lives, society becoming more accepting, some bishops and families becoming more informed, and some wards and stakes becoming more welcoming. This sudden shift reinforced their feelings of isolation, exclusion, and lack of a future, after years of their families and religious leaders reinforcing the bonds of connectedness in a tight web that helped them, held them together with their families. So we're moving, in essence, from connectedness to exclusion. Any wonder why our children would be at risk when, as much younger people, they're still developing coping skills and ways of dealing with this and ways of understanding it and ways of talking about it in their family. So let's think about some of those rejecting behaviors that are putting our young people at risk. We identified many of them, but these are very common ones, like denial. There's no such thing as a gay adolescent. Bisexual youth are invisible. This denial is reinforced by decades of using the phrase same-sex attracted for lesbian, gay, and bisexual identities. But we know that sexual attraction is only one part of a person's sexual orientation. Sexual orientation is about emotional, social, spiritual, and romantic connections, just as it is about sexual connectedness. But when people have profound misinformation about sexual orientation and gender identity, policies, education, guidance from religious sources are impoverished and undermine the well-being of LGBT people, as we've seen with this recent church ruling. Silence and secrecy, not talking about our LGBT family member, making them keep who they are secret, or not talking about it with key sources of support, such as grandparents and extended family. Minimizing their identity, pressuring them to pray, attend religious services to change who they are. Sending them to religious leaders and providers to change their sexual orientation and gender identity. Not letting them participate in a gay-straight alliance or school club that supports LGBT students, and not allowing or enabling students to start and sustain these clubs. Our research has actually shown, by the way, that schools with gay-straight alliances, the school climate is more welcoming. There are fewer instances of bullying. Students who attend these schools, whether they go to school clubs or not, because the climate is different, report better mental health as young adults. They're more likely to graduate high school and attend college. Other rejecting behaviors, like blaming LGBT young people when others mistreat them, or taking the other person's side, whether it's a peer, a family member, bishop, or adult, when they mistreat them. This reinforces these risk behaviors. Telling young people that you're ashamed of them because they're LGBT, excluding them from family events and activities because of who they are, and this includes excluding them from their congregations. Not only are these rejecting behaviors related to high risk for health concerns, but they lead to homelessness, isolation, ending up in foster care, or juvenile justice, and fractured families. So here are some things that we can do to make a difference right now. We all need to educate our families, our friends, our religious leaders, about sexual orientation and gender identity in children and adolescents. Our family education booklets, we've got four different kinds of them. They're available online, although I've been ill recently and somebody told me the link was broken and I have to go find somebody to fix it. But typically you can download them online and we actually disseminate them in hard copy all over the world. This is not a commercial. As some of you know, in addition with doing scores of community and provider education events in Utah, I've donated 30,000 copies of our LDS family education booklets and 1,000 copies of our family education and prevention film, as I said, both of which are best practices for suicide prevention right here in Utah to build the... Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. To buffer the damaging impact from this rejecting external environment that now has become even more rejecting. We need to help our families, our extended families, our religious leaders, members of our congregation, key messages from our research. They don't have to change their values or doctrine to engage in these simple supportive behaviors that can support an LGBT child and reinforce their sense of self-worth, as we would say in our Catholic world, as a child of God. They can love LGBT children, treat them with respect, welcome them to family events, tell them they'll be there for them, stand up for them when others mistreat them, and many other supportive behaviors that significantly help protect against risk and promote well-being. Educate others in your wards and stakes, and call on family and friends to do this in other communities and states. Find out what's going on in your schools and school districts and how they're addressing sexual orientation and school safety. Call on your schools to host parent education events about how to help LGBT students in schools. I know this is anathema, but I've actually been doing this, believe it or not, in Catholic schools, where not a seat is empty, where parents have been so motivated and engaged that they've said to the schools, help us create a support group so we can learn how to support our LGBT children, and of course, doing it in public schools as well. Specifically, I invested the time to develop educational materials that are ADA compliant and that are in the best practices registry for suicide prevention, since schools and other public institutions can only purchase educational materials related to suicide prevention that are approved by the best practices registry for suicide prevention. We've disseminated them in Mexico, Latin America, China, across the U.S., to departments of education in Alabama, certainly in New England, in the Midwest, not here in Utah. Only now, after so much pressure from the media at all, is our public institutions beginning to think, after 9 years of disseminating these, maybe we should start to disseminate them now. In states like Utah that actively prevent accurate information about LGBT people in schools, get involved in your school district and help mobilize families in your communities to move public and elected officials to provide accurate information to school personnel that will enable them to support students in schools, especially LGBT students who are isolated, at risk, and often don't have family support at home. See every parent and caregiver and religious leader and anyone who works with children, youth, and families as a potential ally who has a moral responsibility to support LGBT children and adolescents to prevent these serious health risks that we know are preventable, even if they disagree. I think of a mom in Omaha who carries, she's not Mormon, but she carries the regular version of our family education booklet in her purse, and she gives it to everyone that she sees. I think of a dad in the South who carries it in his jacket pocket and hands it out to people at the what he would call the filling station, the gas station, or in so many other kinds of settings. Be mindful about how we talk about risk for LGBT youth and young people. Don't contribute to that climate of despair that takes away hope. When we talk about risk, as Mitch alluded to, we must also talk about sources of support, education, and guidance, and now there are many of them. Encourage families to get our family education film. Families Are Forever. They can buy it from our website, and we send it right out. We've produced a home version that, as I said, happens to be the only, it's not only the only LDS best practice for suicide prevention, it's the only faith-based best practice for suicide prevention in the National Registry. Every family should see this film and learn how to change the lives of LGBT young people, whether it's their children, someone else in their extended family, or someone else that they know. We're working on an educational version now that we'll distribute soon for use outside the home. Every one of us is an educator, a mentor, a potential source of support for LGBT people, regardless of their age. Compassion, mercy, and love are at the root of Christian values. We must keep those values in mind as we struggle to promote not only the well-being, but the survival of LGBT young people and their connectedness. This is absolutely essential, you know, to wait till future change comes, light is shined, maybe a revelation occurs one day, but we have to support the children who are here now. Thank you very much.
You've been very patient, but I hope that you feel that what we've tried to do here has been useful. Let me close with a few remarks, and then we'll have questions. It's a sober and fearful matter to find oneself at odds with the leaders of one's church. But that is exactly where a number of Latter-day Saints find themselves in relation to the church's new policy on same-sex married couples and their children, in which those entering into same-sex marriages are considered apostates and subject to mandatory disciplinary councils, and their minor children denied the ordinances of infant baptism, and confirmation, and the sons of such couples denied ordination to the priesthood. Such blessings and ordinances, as well as missionary callings, are available to children of same-sex married parents only upon reaching the age of 18 and only on the condition that they assent to the doctrines and practices of the church with regard to same-sex marriage. That is, that they disavow their parents' marriage. Not only did these policy changes seem draconian to some, they seemed to defy common sense, to be in conflict with other gospel principles and church practices, and to be inconsistent with regard to other seemingly more serious parental behaviors and lifestyles. That is, if same-sex marriage is considered a sin, parents are, quote, a particularly grievous or significant serious kind of sin, in the words of Elder Christofferson, one worthy of withholding blessings from the children of such relationships, why wouldn't more serious sins and crimes, such as child neglect, child abuse, and incest, that truly place children in moral and even in mortal danger, be considered even more detrimental and destructive to children? If the church, in the name of love, seeks to protect the children of loving, nurturing, same-sex couples, many of whom, except for their style of marriage, are living gospel standards, how can it justify establishing no restrictions with regard to blessings, ordinances, and calling of children whose parents disregard commandments and the standards of the church and are guilty of serious sins or crimes? At present, a child of a parent who has broken his temple covenants, who is living in an adulterous relationship, who has abused or abandoned his children, and who may be in prison for murder, can receive a name and a blessing, be baptized and confirmed a member of the church, can, if male, be ordained to the priesthood and can serve a mission, whereas a child of a same-sex married couple who are faithful to one another, who love and nurture their children, who live honorable lives and who serve the poor, are denied such blessings and privileges. Even children of unmarried parents living according to church doctrine in adulterous relationships are not denied such blessings and privileges, nor ostensibly are the children of unmarried same-sex couples. Elder Christofferson seemed to justify the policy by saying there could be no compromise with sin. Quote, that was the Savior's pattern. He always was firm in what was right and wrong. He never excused or winked at sin. He never redefined it. He never changed his mind. It was what it was, and that is what it is and where we are. There's no kindness or misdirecting people and leading them into any misunderstanding about what is true, what is right and what is wrong, what leads to Christ and what leads away from Christ. End of quote. But if that's the case, why compromise by singling out same-sex married couples and their children for sanction, especially when those parents and children are striving to live lives devoted to Christ and teaching their children to do the same? One of the cardinal principles of Mormonism is that just as we are, quote, punished for our own sins and not for Adam's transgression, so we should not be punished for another's transgression, if that indeed is what it is. And yet the children of same-sex married parents are being punished for what the church considers the transgression of their parents. How does one explain to an 8-year-old daughter of loving same-sex married parents that her cousin, whose parents are divorced and inactive, is able to be baptized while she is not? Or to a 12-year-old son of same-sex parents that he cannot receive the priesthood, while his best friend, whose mother has abandoned her children, can. To say that such restrictions are not punishment is dishonest. What seems particularly inexplicable is that, according to Elder Nelson, the policy was established out of, quote, compassion for children of same-sex couples. Elder Christofferson states, quote, nothing is lost to the children in the end, if that's the direction they want to go. In the meantime, they're not placed in a position where there will be difficulties, challenges, conflicts that can injure their development in very tender years, end of quote. It seems to me that the opposite is much more likely true. It would be surprising if a child of same-sex parents who are grieved over the church policy change would not experience difficulties, challenges, and conflicts that could injure their development in very tender years. Realistically, a child is much more likely to identify with the sentiments of a loving parent than with an institution she may see as hurting those very parents. Over a period of years, such sentiments might grow into resentment and bitterness toward the church and thereby diminish any chance that the child would choose the church over her parents. And what a selfish choice that is anyway. The unfolding of this policy and what seems like the doctrine behind it was, to say the least, ragged and confusing, and certainly not in accord to well-established protocol for such major changes in policy. From the little we actually know, in response to the Supreme Court's ruling that same-sex marriage was constitutional, the leadership of the church began the process of formulating changes to the General Handbook of Instructions. When a draft of proposed changes was leaked to the press, it seemed to have caught everyone off guard. The result appeared to be an ill-conceived defense of the policy. It took 2 months for Elder Russell M. Nelson to state that the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve, quote, considered countless permutations and combinations of possible scenarios that could arise, end of quote, as a result of the Supreme Court's ruling. Elder Nelson went further to declare that the policy change was the direct result of a revelation from God, quote, we met repeatedly in the temple in fasting and prayer and sought further direction and inspiration. And then when the Lord inspired his prophet, President Thomas S. Monson, to declare the mind of the Lord and the will of the Lord, each of us during that sacred moment felt a spiritual confirmation. It was our privilege as of apostles to sustain what had been revealed to President Monson. Revelation from the Lord to his servants is a sacred process, and so is your privilege, he said to the young people, of receiving personal revelation. Elder Nelson seemed to double down. Follow the prophets. The Lord has promised us that he will never allow the prophet to lead us astray. But of course, we know that on some issues, such as the denial of priesthood ordination to blacks, we were led astray, as we have been on the etiology of homosexuality, which until recently the church taught was a chosen and a changeable orientation. My covenantal relationship to Christ and his kingdom does not require me to surrender my heart and mind, because I sometimes find those who lead us to be in conflict with my own feelings. It's an onerous thing to disagree with the declarative, definitive statements of someone like Elder Nelson. And yet, as Elder Nelson confirmed, it is our privilege as individual saints, and I would add our responsibility, to receive our own witness and to take it seriously when what we understand as truth differs from what church leaders say is truth. It takes both faith and courage and an abundance of charity to respectfully disagree with pronouncements from those charged with knowing and declaring the will of God. At the same time, it seems morally indefensible to go against one's own judgments and one's own conscience, one's own morality. I've been engaged on issues relating to Mormons and gays for over 40 years. Until this new policy was announced, I felt that as a church and as a people, we were moving toward a more enlightened and a more compassionate place with regard to Christ's LGBT children. But it seems that with this change in policy, which results in punishing good, faithful, and loving people and their children. I fear we have taken a giant step backward at the very time we should not only be more eagerly working to improve the lives of gays and lesbians and bisexuals and transgenders in the church, but we should be exercising moral leadership in a world in which homosexuals are being discriminated against, ostracized, denied their human and civil rights, brutalized, and killed. I honestly do not believe that the way we are treating our LGBT members and their families is acceptable to the Lord. I can find nothing in his gospel that justifies what we are doing, and a great deal that condemns it. This is not a position I hold lightly or gladly. In fact, given my love of and my lifelong allegiance and devotion to the church and to my belief in the glorious promises of the restoration, it grieves me. Nevertheless, I take responsibility for my words and actions because my heart offers me no alternative. Thank you. We now have time for questions, and there's a microphone right there if anyone wishes to ask it, and you can address either the panel or an individual member.
I'd like to start out by thanking the four of you for your very unselfish work, sometimes at very great personal cost. And I met three of you personally before. Mitch, I haven't met you, and I'm going to try real hard to obey your injunction to speak kindly. But it's hard at times like this. One thought I had is that spending some time online, there's an unintended consequence that may come from this policy. More and more parents, the Mormons have long criticized other Christians for baptizing babies. They're in no position to know what they're doing, and they're innocent, and so on and so forth. And we patted ourselves on the back because we wait till the ripe old age of 8. Really not exactly informed consent. Well, if more and more parents tell their bishop when their kids are turning 8, well, nothing will be lost if my child waits till he's 18. The church may have second thoughts about this. When I was a freshman at BYU, the very first devotional I went to, I heard Elder Ezra Taft Benson speak to us and say, "The communist leaders are liars, and they will always be liars because they are men without integrity." A week later, Hugh Brown came and tried to undo the damage Benson had done. I fear that the church has lost their Hugh B. Browns, and we've just got the Ezra Taft Bensons now. And that Benson's description of the communist leaders could very well be turned on to the general authorities today. From the words we've heard from you yourselves, our leaders are liars, and they consciously lie to us. That dog and pony show they trotted out to try and describe the revelation and all, it was just very contrived. Losing my train of thought here.
Did you have a specific question?
The question is, how can you and others continue to listen to and follow leadership from men who are proven liars, who glut themselves on the labors of families that can't even feed their kids, and according to Grant Palmer and other insiders, have stipends of $800,000 or more, and teach us things that are not Christian, that are just the opposite of what Christ taught, and behave in the ways opposite of how Christ taught? What of worth is there still there, or is it a function of sunk costs?
I'll let the other members of the panel respond to that. My first impulse is to say, he who has never told a lie, let him cast the first stone. I think about myself. I have not always been a truthful person. There are times in which I find myself shading the truth or whatever. I can't say that they are liars. I don't know their hearts. I know some of them individually as very good men who try to serve the church with integrity. I think there's much we don't know about this particular process. There is some indication that some members of the Quorum of the Twelve did not approve of this and were not present when this decision was made. I don't know, but I do reject a kind of wholesale categorization of them in the same way that I would reject a wholesale categorization of any group. Nevertheless, I think your point is well taken, but anyone want to comment further? There's a microphone right there, right? Yeah, use your own. Oh, yeah, just turn it off.
There's a power switch?
Thank you for your comments, and I understand completely where you're coming from and how you feel. Is it worth going? Is that the essence of your question? Is it worth continuing to go? Well, I have to ask myself that same question some Sundays when I wake up in the morning. And interestingly, there was a recent meeting where I just didn't want to go. I had I was angry, and I went begrudgingly, and I went with the sole purpose to tell people off. That was my goal for that Sunday. And you know what happened? I got there, and I looked around at these faces of these people that I was rather annoyed with, these Mormons in my ward, my neighbors, who hadn't really done much in the way of outreach on LGBT people, and it was frankly pissing me off. And within 5 or 10 minutes, I realized I wasn't really that angry anymore, because these are still my people. This is still my tribe. Is it worth going? Absolutely. Absolutely it's worth going. I don't feel like I answer to anyone in Temple Square. I answer to my Savior. My Savior leads me back here. So yeah, for me, it's definitely worth going.
Thank all of you guys for what you guys do. I grew up in the church, and I grew up as a black male in the church with a father who joined the church, a black father who joined the church in 1971. I grew up with that kind of a background, and that informs my longstanding opinion of many things involving the church. I grew up knowing, or at least feeling, that the church at some point had no interest in me being part of it. And as someone who was also bisexual, I grew up with that aspect as well, and this is another continued slap in the face. I have a wife who has lesbian mothers, so November was tough for my wife. The positive spin on that was it was better for me, because now she's more interested in leaving. But a little bit of light there. But I'm just curious, for the sake of people like my wife and other people who are interested in staying and trying to make this work, what kind of hope can they cling to when it does seem like the constant double down and the retrenchment? How can I, whether it's my best interest or not, in my opinion, try to help my wife understand that maybe this is going to work out for her in the long run? That's, I guess, my question.
Well, I think that, you know, I would say something about that, that every case is different. I think the respect that you have to have within a marriage when there's difference of faith and difference of commitment and difference about a lot of things. It's one of the reasons why Martin Luther called marriage the school of love. It's where we are most challenged, I think, to be loving. And so if you have a wife who loves you and you love her, you can make it work, whatever the differences. I don't mean to suggest by any means that it's easy.
I actually am going to chime in just really quickly here. I'm going to quote somebody who's really smart. I don't know if you guys have heard of this guy, Bob Reese. Look at the name of this institution. Whose name is in the title? Whose name? Answer that. Yes. Latter-day Saints. Okay, well, Jesus Christ is there, but also Latter-day Saints. This is not the Church of the Brethren, brothers and sisters. This is the Church of the Latter-day Saints. And look next to you. Look behind you, look in front of you. We are the church. we are the Latter-day Saints. This is our church. Yes, it is worth going, and yes, it is hard right now, and yes, it belongs to us, and it's our job to make it as good as we can.
Nadine.
Even though I had my name removed over this policy, I'm still trying to educate people who are still in. So, Mitch, I'd like to ask you a question about the firesides that you talked about. I don't know how you... I'd like you to tell us about what is done in these firesides, because I can imagine a lot of really hurtful things that can happen in those firesides as well, where things come up like what Caitlin talked about, where you're calling people same-sex attracted, where you're not giving them any hope for the future, where you might just be telling people that they have to stay celibate for life, and not giving them any options other than that. And I would like to see these kinds of things take place if they are really helpful, but I'm just wondering what it is you do in them that is helpful. So could you elaborate?
I can. I'll elaborate briefly, and I'm happy to connect with you after this as well. So the first element to making these successful is to choose an informed group to have them with. And we all know who those people are in our wards and in our stakes. The second key element is to hold them off campus. You can call them Mormon, but do not expect or want them to be LDS church sponsored, because then comes a rigorous set of rules that you must follow. The third element is to choose speakers who you know are educated and informed on this topic. The website for The Hearth, if you Google it, it's the hearth, LDSHearth.org. Actually uses some of the SSA language in its website, but it also combines that with LGBT. We do that not because we believe that SSA is a thing that actually exists, but because that helps us actually appeal to, for example, a mom and dad who came a couple of months ago, whose 16-year-old son had literally just come out the week before. So those are a couple of the elements that we use to make these successful.
Yes, brother.
I'm a very active, committed Latter-day Saint who's currently serving two part-time missions for the church. When the announcement was made in November, I was so shocked and appalled, I wrote a letter to the First Presidency to express my grief. I never heard a word. I was told, and I believe, that any letter to the First Presidency always ends up with the stake president and probably the bishop again. But I'd like to ask you, panel members, for those of us who are still in the church and actively participating, how can we best let our voices be heard? What can we do at this point to help make a difference?
So thank you for that question. The question is, how do we make a difference? I get asked that same question a lot. I had a friend recently who came to me with very similar request, a little bit different spin. She asked me, Mitch, how do you do it? How do we stay in when it looks so dark, when it just doesn't feel like anything's changing? And what I told her was, it is not my responsibility to change the institution of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It is not my job or my responsibility to make that change. That belongs to my Savior. I view the church, when it comes to the LGBT topic, as a very large ship that has encountered an iceberg, and it is sinking, and it is sinking fast. There's water coming on board. That ship is over there on the horizon, and I am here inside this lifeboat. What my responsibility is to take the hands of the people who throw them over the top of my boat and pull them into safety. I can't help the ship. I can't help who is on the ship, but I can help who is right here in front of me right now today. And I do that by letting people know who I am, that I am an ally, and that I am a safe space.
But I would also like to encourage you not to give up the idea of writing letters. Those letters will be read by somebody, and they will be filed away. And if they continue to be inundated, somebody has to be impressed at that. The time has probably passed when any general authorities give back personal responses. I have a file of personal responses I received to letters, but I haven't tried any for quite some time. But to speak to your own bishop, to talk to your own stake president, but you see, I live in a very unusual place, and my Oakland stake has been on the front page of the Salt Lake Tribune a few years ago for the excellent, unusual work that we did in terms of better understanding and loving our gay brothers and sisters. I don't know how much of that would be taken on by stake presidents these days. I don't know. But anybody who stays in within the borders of the church in whatever way you do, I think has an obligation to find creative ways to say, this is wrong, and I'm doing what I can about it now. And I ask you as my bishop, I ask you as my stake president to be very much aware of this and to do what you can. I have spoken with both my stake president and bishop who came to me after the policies were enacted just saying, I want to talk about what we're going to, you know, what can we expect? How can we handle this? So don't anybody be shy about it. And if they throw you out, so what? We all have to follow our own conscience. And somehow or other, the great alchemist, who is God, our heavenly parents, can find a way to turn dross into gold. And we need to use our two little hands folded snugly and tight to do what is right and to be creative in finding more and better ways to do that.
I would also add that since I'm as old as I am, that I certainly could have left the church over the black issue and over the feminist issue and over a lot of other issues. But Lowell Bunyan said, Lowell was a friend of mine, and I remember him saying, you can't, it's much more difficult to try and change the church from the outside. So I'm glad that there are people like Mitch who are manning the lifeboats, but I'm more audacious. I want to change the ship, and I think that Mitch, you are changing the ship, and I know Carolyn is, and Caitlin is, and let's try and get it before it sinks, and all that's left is lifeboats. I'd rather be on the ship that is repaired. Someone said the ship of faith is like being at sea, repairing a ship that needs repairing one plank at a time. I kind of like that metaphor, but I also respect people who, out of pain, I know the pain that is in this room. I'm feeling it right now. So everyone has to make that choice. It's the wonderful thing about the Lord's great gift of agency, is that we can choose to stay or to leave, or to stay with conditions, or to leave with conditions, or to leave and then come back, or whatever we do, that's a choice. And I think if we make it out of integrity, if we make it within the framework of the best moral decisions we can make, I think Christ is going to be happy with us.
I think time is up.
Well, ask a question where we can...
So I've been... quick response to Nadine. One of the groups, we held our last fireside on the 24th of July, and somebody gave a wonderful presentation on pioneer strength and independence and how we could draw on those sources to defend, to stick up for ourselves, and it was really wonderful, actually. That was just the last one, which unfortunately Mitch wasn't able to come to. My natural response to this, I happened to be out of town. I was so angry. I did write to my bishopric, wrote to Salt Lake with a bunch of other people, but I'm normally a voice of reconciliation and love in these situations, and all I wanted to do was go on strike. And I don't know what... I want people's response to that idea. Are there enough people who are upset that we could say, you know, the month of November is a year after this thing and we're not happy and we're going to, you know, not do our callings for a month and see what happens?
And for some of us, we say, well, what's different about that?
That's part of the problem. Some of us do a good job in our callings, but, I mean, I love my bishopric, I love my ward and stake, and it's sort of like I'm cutting off one part of me to support another part, and I don't know whether that's too antagonistic. I actually want people's response to it.
Yeah. If anyone wants to respond to Kim, and then this will be the last question to this brother here. So anyone want to respond to Kim about a strike or a...
They wouldn't care.
Can I say one thing that one woman did? She was so concerned that she took her whole year's tithing and she paid it to Affirmation. So I'm not advocating that necessarily, but I'm putting that idea out there.
Family Acceptance Project right here is also a good use of your tithing dollars, folks.
And it's tax deductible, too.
This brother.
Well, I'll be real brief. I know our time is over. But first, Brother Reese and Bob, I appreciate your eloquent remarks. And one comment I'd make, having worked in the corporate world for 35-plus years, if I implemented a policy as raggedly as the church did, I would at least be reprimanded and may have lost my job. So... I, you know, kind of have the feeling that there's no bad people, but there's a lot of bad systems, and maybe we're a victim of that. My question is to Mitch. You know, I'm not that tuned into that. I believe you are on a podcast called Out in Zion, or you participated in that?
Yes.
So what is the state of the millennials your age and others that are couples that are still in the church? I mean, have they fled? Are they still participating? And have you heard of any disciplinary action taken by brethren against those couples?
It's a couple-part question. So what is the state of married LGBT couples around my age in the church? I think we have one sitting in the audience here. Many of them, I'll just speak to San Francisco for my area, because I think the answer, again, is a little bit with leadership roulette. It depends on who your leadership is. My leadership has absolutely no intent to execute this policy. The leadership that I work with in other cities, I won't name names, Seattle, and a couple other areas, share that intent. There is no witch hunt going on in the areas that I'm familiar with and the areas that I have worked with in the past. That said, that it is happening in some areas, and I do know that is true for a fact. Some LGBT couples have stopped going. Some are still going. I think the sentiment in San Francisco really looks a little bit something like this. Look, I'm kind of tired of being jacked around. I don't want home teachers. I don't want to go on Sunday. I might go to a fireside on occasion, but I don't want to be excommunicated. That's pretty much the sentiment, if I can be so bold as to encapsulate that. The second part of your question I've forgotten. Which was, yeah, so I answered it, didn't I? I didn't forget it.
Yeah.
So it's late in the day on a Saturday. I'm due for some Diet Coke, I think.
Let me close by saying that one of the things I felt it was a privilege when I was a bishop was sitting on the stand and looking into the faces of the people in my congregation and knowing and feeling the pain. There's a lot of sorrow and sadness in this room today. Rightfully so. Each of us can love and put our arms around and try to diminish that pain and that anguish and that sorrow and that loneliness. We're all called to do that, whatever else we're called to do. So take time to be aware of people who need that and to express it to one another. Thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate it.